Hello and welcome to episode 416 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. If you want to be LSAT famous, you can share news and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. This is going to air on Monday, August 21st. I guess you have a free class coming up, Nathan, on Thursday, September 14th. Did you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I'm excited. It's just a free version of my normal Thursday class. So hope everybody can join.
Okay, cool. You can sign up for that at lsat.link/free. Producer Eric has kindly put some PSAs on the top of the podcast agenda today. Let's go ahead and jump into these. Number one, I'll go ahead and read this. One, we got a lot of listener emails about the remote proctoring issues for the August LSAT. It sounds like there were problems, right? LSAC and Prometric had offered to make up test days for these problems. And I guess those are going to happen on August 20th and 21st or 19th and 20th. Anyways, I don't know what else there is to say about that, except that people were upset.
People were upset. It's nothing new. They've had lots of bumps in the road as they've tried to roll out this new Prometric dual mode testing thing. I don't know if the problems are on Prometric's end or LSAC's end. We got an email where LSAC kind of owned it, right? They're like, well, it doesn't really matter if it's Prometric or if it's us, because
that's an interesting read, because I would say they said it was Prometric's fault and then said, well, it doesn't matter. And so that was
at some point in there, they acknowledged that no one gives a shit whether it's Prometric or whether it's you. It's still you. It's the LSAT. Yeah. So they know that they need to get that shit fixed. I hope that people don't freak out here and think everyone had problems. It's not true that everyone had problems. We got plenty of emails from people saying, I crushed the LSAT today. So it's not the case that everyone who tried to take the test had problems. And it is certainly not the case that people should try to take the test in person to avoid these kinds of problems. I think that that's really bad strategy. I think that you're going to be more comfortable taking it at home. More often than not, it's going to be easier taking it at home. I don't see any reason why people would all flock to the in-person test. I think the in-person test should, you know, if anything, it's going to be more stressful. You're in an unfamiliar environment. I don't think you should go that route unless you really can't get a quiet place with stable internet. So if you have a quiet place with stable internet at home, I really think people should be taking the test at home.
Yeah, I agree.
Hopefully they're going to smooth these things out next time. I think Eric makes a really good point, though. And this is, I think, the thing that people should think about the most, is that experiences like this are a lot less stressful if you assume that you're going to take the test multiple times. Remember, your competitors, your savvy competitors, are taking this test multiple times, confident in the knowledge that only their high score is really going to matter. If you are one of these, no, I'm going to be a one and done. You know, I hear this all the time. I really only want to take it once.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, you really want to hit a home run on the first pitch too. I get it. You really want to hit a home run on the first pitch. But if you don't hit a home run on the first pitch, you need to have a backup plan.
Are you going
to
just step back and let all the remaining
strikes
fall?
You just go right back to the dugout. No, it's just one, you know, one strike and I'm out. Yeah, didn't hit a home run. Well, that's it. I'm done. I guess this is not for me. So your savviest competitors are well prepared for the first time they take it. They know they're prepared because their practice test scores indicate that they're ready to take it. Yep. So they look at their practice test scores and they go, yeah, that's pretty good. The range of my last five tests, there's some really good ones in there. And I'd be happy to put that on my official record. Okay, I'm going to go sit for the official LSAT.
Yep.
Some of those people do hit a home run on their first attempt and then maybe they're done. But other people hit a foul ball or swing and miss entirely or whatever. They don't get their very best score on their first official attempt. And they're
they get to second base, but they got to second base. It's like, you could have got the third. You could have got home. Like, don't just settle.
We call that a double or a triple. So like, it is possible that they, you know, scratched out a single, but they know that they're a power hitter. They look at their record and they go, their practice test record, and they go, no, I've got some home runs on there. I'm not going to settle for a single. And they decide to take it a second time, maybe a third time, maybe a fourth time, maybe even a fifth time. And it's always worth it as long as you have practice test scores that indicate that you can score higher than what you actually scored. The people who really melt down and totally freak out are the people who are like, no, this is the biggest, most important day of my life. It's like, you know, my wedding day, and it has to have perfect weather, and everybody has to do exactly perfectly what I have planned them to do. And the flowers have to be perfect, and the catering has to be perfect. And then, you know, one little thing goes wrong and people have this complete crash and burn. These stresses, we should put scare quotes around that, right? Stresses. About things like, oh, your test didn't start on time. You had a hard time communicating with the proctor.
Yeah.
I get it that it's frustrating, but it really shouldn't be stressful, I don't think, if you have the right mindset around this test. If you just know, shit can happen, that's fine. You might even like smile a little bit. If you really have the right mindset, you might go, oh, proctor connection issues with Prometric. That's going to really cause other people problems.
Yep.
You know,
That's an advantage for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say the word sinister. It's like a little bit of a sinister smile. Kind of like, yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck with that, everyone. I got it. But
totally.
I know you're not. I know some people are not going
to
get it.
No. And it's like me showing up to the first tee. And there's the wind is howling or there's a little bit of rain. And I'm like, you know, I don't like the rain any more than you like the rain. I don't want to get wet. I don't want to be cold. But I know that this happens sometimes.
Yeah.
And I know that we're going to go out and play golf no matter what here. And if I attach myself to the rain, you know, then it's like I'm losing voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just setting myself up for, oh, this sucks. I hate this. This is fucking wind and rain and this is bullshit. Why are we even doing this? Okay, well, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should just go straight to the bar and forfeit your match or whatever if you don't like the rain. And you know, you got to flip that. You got to be looking at your opponent going, oh yeah, you don't like that, do you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look how wet you are.
The same thing applies through the entire test, right? We're talking about Prometric and getting started with the test. But how about that first game?
Of a bad game, exactly.
Yeah. First game, you're like, oh, this isn't going very well. This looks like a harder first game than I would expect.
Right.
Okay, great. That's where you smile, right? That's where you go, okay, I'm gonna figure this out, and a bunch of other people are gonna crash and burn.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we're not trying to bring other people down, but to the extent it helps you, do it.
Well, there aren't even any other people to look at, right? You're in a testing, you're
by yourself. There's literally, you're going to have no impact on them, but it will have an impact on you.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Like a metaphorical look to your left, look to your right and go, you guys are going to struggle with this.
Yeah.
I'm recognizing that it's maybe more difficult than what I was accustomed to. You know, it could be reading comp. It could be logical reasoning, you know, a question that you don't automatically solve it right away.
Yeah.
A passage that you have a hard time getting into after a couple of sentences, you have to reread it, but you look to your left, look to your right metaphorically, and you go, you suckers aren't even rereading. Like, what are you doing? Really? You think you're done reading that passage already? You just blaze right through it, huh? Okay. Well, good luck. You know, let's see how you do on answering those questions. Cause I don't believe you. I don't believe that you've figured it out.
Yeah.
This whole game that you can play to just put yourself in a much more powerful mental state.
Yep.
Anyhow, we'll see. They do have makeup test dates. If you were affected, you already know. And you've already been offered a makeup test and maybe you're already retaking it by the time this episode comes out. Good luck to everybody.
Yep. Okay. PSA number two has to do with discounts. You want to read this one?
Yeah, we have a robust fee waiver discount program. If you qualify for the LSAC fee waiver, which everybody should apply for the LSAC fee waiver. We need to make that the PSA, actually. Apply for the LSAC fee waiver, y'all. If you have not already applied for the LSAC fee waiver, you should do it. And, you know, you might think that you don't qualify, but you never know until you apply. It's possible that certain aspects of your finances are not going to be counted in LSAC's verification of your financial circumstances. I don't know. I don't really know much about what their process looks like right now. I do know that some people, though, have been surprised that they've applied for the fee waiver and gotten it. I know other people who have applied for the fee waiver, gotten denied, and then appealed. There is an appeal process. And I know lots of people who have gotten the fee waiver on appeal. So apply for the fee waiver, appeal if you think you have legitimate chance. And if you get it, you're going to get, what, two free takes at the LSAT. You're going to get the Credential Assembly Service. I forget what they call it now. It's not the Credential Assembly Service anymore, is it? It's something else.
Oh, they changed the name? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a recent thing. They've changed nomenclature so many times that I have a hard time following it.
What did you call it? You called it
Credential Assembly Service, CAS.
Yeah, it looks like it's still called CAS on here. Yeah, Credential Assembly Service. Yep.
Okay, so that's the same. That's still the same. Fine. You also get some of the reports that they have to send out to law schools. You get those for free.
They're called CAS reports, apparently.
Now. CAS reports. Okay, so you get the Credential Assembly Service for free. You get the CAS reports for free, like six of them.
Six, yep.
You're going to want to apply to more schools than that. So, you know, you're still save up your money for your applications.
Yep.
You get the, Prep Plus, which now that's not called Prep Plus anymore. They just changed that name. I forget what that name is now.
It's Law Hub Advantage.
Law Hub Advantage, which is just access to their tests.
Yep.
There's no advantage to using Law Hub, y'all. If you're a Demon subscriber, you should be doing your tests and stuff in the Demon, not in Law Hub. But you do get that for free if you get the Credential Assembly Service. If you get the fee waiver. Also, pretty much any law school that charges an application fee, they will probably waive your application fee if you get the LSAC fee waiver. So, all told, I think you get like a couple thousand dollars worth of benefit. And then if you do that, definitely let help@lsatdemon.com know, because we have, we give our basic service. We were charging $30 because that's the LSAC fee, the fee that they charge us. They just raised that recently. So we're going to have to raise that, I assume. So it's like $38 or something like that. And that'll get you 4 months worth of LSAT Demon Basic for just that LSAC fee of $38. If you qualify for the fee waiver, we'll also give you 20% off of any paid plan. So I really encourage people again to apply for that fee waiver. If you haven't already, you might be surprised and it might be $2,000 in your pocket. It'll also get you really nice discounts on LSAT Demon if you're interested.
Cool. Number three here is the LSAT Demon Discord. We'll keep this short because it's really for people who have an LSAT Demon account. But if you do have an LSAT Demon account, you can go to lsat.link/discord, and that will add you to our Discord server. And then you can communicate with a bunch of other Demon students. So
yeah, that needs to go out in the newsletter to all of our students. And we should be mentioning that in our classes as well. But lsat.link/discord. If you're a paid Demon student, you can get into that community and say hi.
Yep. Last one, number four, updated rules for LSAT writing. Scratch paper is now prohibited along with any other writing implements unless otherwise specified in an approved accommodation letter. Okay. The LSAT writing interface will include digital scratch paper, which allows test takers to type notes instead of writing them on a physical piece of scratch paper. Wow. Okay. Yeah, apparently. And then I think I was talking to one student in class and they were curious whether they could copy and paste inside of this scratch paper. Like if they took notes and then they wanted to rearrange. And the answer to that is apparently no. So,
okay, yeah, I mean,
there's very little functionality here.
Can you even control C, control V on LSAT writing?
Apparently not. That's what they were trying to do.
Yeah, they're getting rid of all the keyboard shortcuts.
So you're pretty, that's rough. Like if you write a paragraph and you're like, nope, actually I want to put that paragraph after this paragraph, you're stuck. It sounds like
it's fucking stupid is what it is. I mean, because for real, like if you don't use control C, control V when you're writing, then you suck at writing.
Yeah.
Like I don't know. There's no one who writes. It's not like, oh no, it just comes out of my brain all fully formed.
In the order that it should be. Yeah. All ideas have been processed correctly.
Right. Yeah. It's just strange, you know, it's like, I get it. They're doing it for security. But they're so, yeah, I don't know. It's like, they're so worried that someone's going to steal the LSAT writing prompt.
That, and what? Like, there's no value in that, right? There's not like scores hanging on the line.
I don't understand it. I would chalk it up to LSAT writing doesn't really matter very much. There's many schools don't even look at it. Other schools, if they do look at it, they're going to look at it, you know, down the list of all the other things that they're going to look at. Your UGPA, your LSAT, your personal statement, you know, and then eventually at some point, if they really can't decide, maybe they take a look at your LSAT writing. But it's strange because, you know, now they're testing like a different type of writing. If you can't copy paste, then that's not modern. That's not how people write.
No, it's can you think through your in your head exactly what you want to say and spill it out.
Maybe they've added, though, you know how they added the find box instead of control F on the LSAT. They now have the find box at the top of the screen. Maybe they're going to have some like copy, like you click
button
to copy and click to paste. That could be. Who knows what they're doing. Anyway, remember, LSAT writing is not scored and you have to do it. It will be released along with your LSAT score to all schools, but some schools don't look at it at all. Other schools are going to look at it, you know, seventh in their list of things that they're going to look at for you. So it's just not anything to worry about.
Yeah. Today on the show, we have special guest Ross Guberman. You're a legal writing expert. You're also the president and founder of Legal Writing Pro. You've conducted thousands of workshops on legal writing on five continents for prominent law firms, judges, agencies, corporations, and associations. You're also the author of multiple best-selling books on legal writing, including Point Made, How to Write Like the Nation's Top Advocates. Your newest project is Brief Catch, which is an AI-powered legal writing tool. It was named one of TechnoLawyer's top 10 legal tech products of the year. You're also my former boss and mentor back when I was in law school at George Washington. You hired me, thankfully, to help with Legal Writing Pro, and that was amazing. How's it going, Ross?
Yeah, you were stuck with me for quite a few years. You probably didn't know what you were getting into.
I know. I didn't know what I was getting into. It was just like a job to, I don't know, pay the bills in law school, but it turned into quite a bit more. It was a lot of fun.
Ross, were you hiring specifically at GW? Like, are you a GW grad yourself?
No. I went to University of Chicago, but I had been teaching there and had quite a fondness for the school. And I think I did begin my search, you know, right in my backyard, so to speak. And, you know, Ben must have reached out and made a great impression, and the rest is history. We sort of created this company together. I mean, it was the very, very early years of my workshop business. So we're sort of making it up as we went along.
Yeah. Wore a lot of different hats. It was fun. Yeah. Sorry, Nathan.
Ben was the practical one, which I definitely needed.
Well, it was fun. It was, I mean, in my introduction, I mentioned that you conducted thousands of workshops on five continents. I mean, at that time, right, you were flying all over the country. You'd be doing classes at law firms in the morning and in the afternoon, and then catching a flight and going to another town. Was it always the next day, or would you stay in a town for a couple of days? I can't even remember now.
Well, I sort of prided myself on my travel toughness. I don't know if you remember, I once had, maybe you were gone by then, but I had 6 days in a row in six cities. And somehow I stupidly booked myself in New York, LA, New York, San Francisco, and I think Chicago, and then Boulder, Colorado. So that was sort of the peak of the madness. But it's an interesting niche market, kind of law firm training, because just a couple people usually capture the whole market, because one firm follows another. So yeah, at one point I know there was a year where I had done something like 242 workshops.
Yeah. And at all, I mean, all the big name firms, right? Any firm that anyone's ever heard of was hiring you to come in. And then I guess some of this slowed down after the pandemic.
Well, it's slowed down because I transitioned into legal tech. But it is true that there's not the same hunger for kind of formal training that there was, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, where people didn't think twice about sitting in a room for 3 or 4 hours. That's a little bit passe, I suppose, at this point. You know, perhaps, you know, a little bit because of COVID, but even before, I think the three or four or six hour, you know, classroom style workshop was already getting a little bit dated.
Yeah, hard for people to push through. I suspect that when you started, people didn't have smartphones, right? They had flip phones.
Yeah, but then barely. Yeah, the flip phones were no fun. There. You know, people didn't bring them around with them everywhere because there was nothing to do. There wasn't even that, you know, what was that BlackBerry game?
There was T9 word texting, and there was also, well, don't forget about the snake game. The snake game was awesome on those phones.
But that was even a little later. I mean, I remember flip phones really, really bare bones, you know, basically.
You flip it open and then it has like a dial inside to dial the numbers on it.
Something like that. Yeah, go through a telephone operator.
Martha.
But it is funny, having done this for so many years, to think about how the audience changed, because you're absolutely right. As time went on, it was harder and harder to, you know, for people to focus for 3 hours because of phones.
Yeah. Well, I do remember teaching classes even early on, and we'd take a break, and for 15 minutes, I'd come back into the classroom and everyone was talking with each other, just lots of noise, right? And then I don't know when that transition took place, but when smartphones started becoming much more common, I would come back into the classroom after the break, crickets. Everybody's on their phone. No one's talking to each other.
So interesting. And that was even, I did actually teach an upper level seminar in law school for a number of years. So I did see some of those changes, and it was absolutely, and what you describe is absolutely true. I think, you know, there's like awkwardness, a good kind of awkwardness in those classrooms when there weren't smartphones. So people just naturally chatted, and I could tell that law students became a little bit more isolated from one another as the years went on.
Well, so Ross, when we were talking recently, I thought, hey, it would be great to have you come on the show, just given the experience you have with so many different attorneys at every point in their career, all the way from law students up to judges and partners and wherever people might end up at the end of their career. And I think as people listen to this show, they're trying to figure out how to do well on the LSAT, obviously, but they're also trying to figure out how to get into law school. And they're also just wondering, should I even be doing this? And when we were talking earlier, you mentioned, what was it? You went to the University of Chicago Law School and you hadn't thought through that much, or I can't remember exactly what you said, but yeah, what was your experience there?
I honestly knew nothing, and I mean nothing. Like, there was no Law and Order back then, so I didn't even know whatever one picks up from Law and Order. So I kind of ran away from a PhD program and started law school a little bit on a whim. And the only thing I thought to myself is I didn't have very much money growing up. I thought, well, I'll do whatever you need to do to make money, but I didn't even know what that actually would entail. So I was, yeah, I don't know if I was at a disadvantage or an advantage, but I definitely had no idea what was going on the first couple of weeks of law school.
Yeah. And what did you think of it as you started to figure that out?
Well, frankly, I found the first months pretty tough, especially the first month. I felt like other students, you know, were better prepared, or seem to have had much more exposure to what was going on. But, you know, there's a little bit of a leveling effect as the weeks go on. And I loved it in my own way. I mean, I found it really stimulating and really challenging, but I didn't have as much confidence as I'd had, you know, in the schools I'd gone to before. And I ended up with a pretty good career, which might make some people feel good, right? I definitely started out like way behind, I'd say.
way behind in the sense that you didn't know exactly what you were going to do, or?
Well, I would even go further than that and say just way behind and not really understanding what the hell the professors were talking about for many weeks at least.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a shock to the system, but, you know, in ways both good and bad, I'd say.
So, and your initial plan too was just to go into big law, right?
Right. And I mean, I'll just be candid and say, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as big law. I mean, I knew there were law firms. That was about it. I mean, I notice nowadays a lot of law students I interact with already know the names of all the big firms. And I'm not sure exactly why it is they know that before law school, but I can tell you, I would not have been able to name any firm, and probably not able to name more than one or two Supreme Court justices either. So I'm sure people are shocked, but that's kind of how ignorant I was.
Were you first generation?
Yeah. Yeah. But I, you know, I also had, you know, I'd gone to Yale. I'd been in Paris. I mean, I should have known more than I did, even though I am first gen, as they now say. And, you know, frankly, I think I was maybe a little bit combination of naive and cocky. I thought, oh, it's just school. You know, it's just more school. I'll just go to another school and, you know, figure it out. But it was, yeah, it was, you know, it can feel a little bit remote and alien if you're not familiar with language. I mean, I absolutely remember when they would say common law, I had no idea what the heck common law meant. So when they started talking about contracts and torts, I had no idea that judges sort of created those doctrines as they went along. And I also didn't know that all that had roots in England or any of those things that for many other students are quite obvious. I did love my legal writing class, though.
I guess that's not surprising given where you ended up. So you did do big law for a little while. And then what prompted you to move in a different direction?
Well, I absolutely enjoyed big law. It was exciting. It was quite satisfying. Had good experiences, but you know, a little bit like today with what's going on in AI, this was also a sort of boom time for tech. You know, dating myself, talking 1999, 2000. It was like what was then called like the .com boom. A lot of, you know, just I was in Washington. A lot of like partners at my firm were going to AOL, and you know, AOL was not, you know, it was very different from what it's known for today. Things like that were happening. People were kind of exuberant, and it just felt like a good time for me to see what else was out there. But I wasn't quite sure exactly, you know, what I was going to do. So a couple of years went by, and then I decided to enter the legal writing workshop business. And then I found Ben.
Are you still interacting with law students today on some level, or what's happening?
Well, a lot of law students are assigned my book. So a lot of law students know who I am. They recognize me in the airports and so forth. So I do actually interact with quite a few just day to day, or they email me or they follow me. I also, until quite recently, did quite a bit of training for summer associates. So I would meet a lot of law students then. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but I don't teach at a law school. I haven't done that in a while, but you know, I love law students. So I find them, you know, it's refreshing, always interested to hear how law school has changed. I just went to my own 25th reunion, and you know, you can see some reforms and some changes in the vibe.
Yeah. What changes stick out to you the most?
Well, going back to what I said before, I feel like law students are much more sophisticated now about the profession. I mean, I'm sure it's partly because of access to social media and, you know, other online resources, but just more sophisticated, often have what to me seem like very, very specific ideas of what kind of practice they want to go into, even as 1Ls. So there's that. But I also see a lot more struggle. I'd say there's, you know, that's kind of the positive. On the negative side, a lot of law students seem, you know, to have more struggles during the law school years, or, you know, sometimes more self-doubt than might have been the case, you know, 10, 20 years ago. It also generally seems to me that law school has modernized a little bit, that some professors are, you know, they experiment a little bit more with methodology. They're not as Socratic as they were in my day. There are more clinics, you know, there are more opportunities, I think, to get practical experience. There are more adjunct professors, I believe, which isn't always great. I mean, some of them are bad at teaching. They're just good at practice, but it does, I think, does make law school a little bit more practical. And that's probably for the good.
Yeah. I think one thing that Nathan and I have talked about on the show before is how impractical some aspects of law school seem to be, right? Like the disconnect between what you talk about in law school and what you actually end up doing in practice. Not that we're experts on that, but there does seem to be some disconnect.
There is. And I mean, I think people have been sounding that theme for a while. I'm very much, obviously I do legal writing. I'm very much immersed in the practical side of being a lawyer, since I work with people on how to actually produce work product. But I'm not quite sold on this idea that law schools should be, you know, criticized constantly for being theoretical. I think you do need a mix, and law school is not a trade school. It shouldn't be a trade school. And I'm not necessarily one who thinks, oh, you need to learn like the number of days you have to serve process. You can learn a lot of these kind of facts and rules, you know, in practice. If you're smart enough to go to law school, you got to give yourself some credit. On the other hand, it does seem kind of odd that the basic curriculum hasn't changed in like a century, right? The main 1L classes haven't changed. So I see it both ways, but I'm not necessarily sure that all the things in law school that seem, you know, divorced somehow from practice are useless. I think sometimes they really help you think about the law in more creative ways, or they just kind of stretch your mind. And even though you can't necessarily link those, you know, those individual classes or even semester long classes to anything specific in practice, I think sometimes they do more good than we realize.
Maybe it's the process of how to think about things and how to question, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. One example of how things are better now is like when I took contracts, and again, I had no idea what the heck the professors were saying for a while. You just started with these early England cases about the different ships named Peerless, and you know, very methodical, kind of repetitive. And I know nowadays they do things that now might seem obvious, like they'll actually show the students the contract in question in the case. You can actually look at it and see what the judge is even talking about. So I do think law schools are better nowadays at trying to marry the two. So you have sort of doctrine and theory, but at least they try, at least some professors try to let students see how these cases actually arose and who the parties were and what they were really wanting and so forth.
I guess I just want to know, you know, like, what's the point of 3 years of law school if you're not going to learn that stuff?
Well, there's this notion that you're learning how to think like a lawyer. And, you know, if you ask around, it's actually really hard to get people to describe what that actually means. I think it's one of these, like they say about pornography, you know, when you see it, it's just sort of, you just assume that you walk out of there 3 years later with a different kind of mind.
So it's bullshit. Well,
I don't know. I mean, if it were totally bullshit, then you could basically just do an online course, like memorizing rules and, you know, rules of civil procedure and rules of evidence, and then go out and be a great lawyer. And I'm not really sure there's any evidence, no pun intended, that's
because it's never been allowed. I mean, there's no evidence.
I mean, it used to be allowed in the sense that you could, if you could pass the bar, you could be a lawyer in some states years ago. And it might be true that those lawyers were completely competent. You know, I don't know. I don't think there's ever been any like formal study, but I do believe that the law is more than just a set of like random rules. So probably the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle, because the thing is if you're a good lawyer, and the, you know, like in every profession, there are good ones, average ones, and below average ones. If you're a good one, you're always reinventing yourself, and you have to adapt to things that weren't even around or doctrines that didn't exist when you were in school. And, you know, you want to have sometimes a good, just general apparatus for dealing with that. But of course, I went to a very theoretical law school. So maybe I'm, you know, biased just because of the nature of the legal education I had.
You also went to a school with elite, you know, you had an elite cohort there. The top schools are very different from the schools middle of the pack.
They're very different in many, many ways, you know, more obvious and less obvious. I think that's absolutely true. And it's, you know, it starts with even the, well, I was going to say the curriculum, not so much the actual classes you take, but just the sort of mindset's very different. And it's partly based on the, you know, the career trends. What, you know, at any one law school, what do the students actually do career-wise? And I think that even that affects all 3 years. At a school like Chicago, you have really zero chance of not getting a job, to be frank.
Right.
I mean, you could be the lowest ranked school in your class and have a terrible personality in interviews, and you're still going to get a really good job. And although I don't think they actually came out and said that, actually, you know what? They did tell us that. Now, when I think about it, and I remember thinking it was strange to be told that, it absolutely affects everything, you know, consciously and unconsciously.
Yeah. And that is very, very different when we get to a school that's ranked, you know, 60th in the country or something like that. It is very possible to go to those schools and never get a legal job. You know, the big law firms want to talk to every single person in the class at Chicago. The big law firms do not want to talk to every single person in the class at Hastings or whatever we're talking about.
That's right. And, you know, I don't like to generalize about professors, but it's certainly been my experience that at many law schools, the professors are not as in touch with the realities of looking for a job as they.
No, because they went to Yale. I mean, you know,
it's true. It's interesting. All law schools at up and down the U.S. news rankings, the professors aren't that different from one to the next.
Right.
It's true.
Yeah. They went to Yale. They went to Harvard. They went to Stanford. They went to Yale. They practiced big law for 2 years, became a professor.
Actually,
and now they're teaching at Hastings.
Some didn't practice.
Or didn't practice
for 2 years
at all. And now they're teaching at Hastings, and they're teaching a bunch of theoretical bullshit about how to think like a lawyer. And meanwhile, it's like, listen, these kids are in peril of not passing the bar exam. Like, they're not going to pass the bar exam. You need to teach them like shit that's going to move them toward, you know, being able to practice any kind of law. And you're doing this highfalutin, and it's 3 years of just highfalutin garbage. And then, you know, I mean, half those people never have a legal career.
It's a really important question whether law schools have some sort of almost ethical obligation to make sure that almost all of their students pass the bar. I mean, you know, it's easy for me to say the answer should be yes, but I really do think the answer should be yes because of the debt load and also the opportunity cost, you know, of the 3 years. And to see someone, you know, not that this is going to happen to anyone listening, but to see someone spend those 3 years and get a degree and never, you know, never pass the bar.
It is going to happen.
It's upsetting.
To a significant portion of our listenership. It's a fact. It's just what happens.
Yeah. And, you know, there are many schools. You can go into the school and you'll see 30% don't pass the bar, but no one thinks, hey, I'm going to be in that 30%.
Right. I'm here to tell you, folks out there in the listening audience, it's like 30% of you are not going to pass the bar. I'm sorry. That's how it is.
Not the first time, at least. I mean, many people do pass it the second, third, or fourth time, but yeah.
It's still, Can you imagine the nightmare?
It's rough. It's and again, life. Talk about elite. Like the one type of employment where it's okay not to pass the bar, fancy law firms, you can keep your job, at least if you fail it once. But for most people, they don't have the luxury of, you know, not passing.
What happens at the fancy law firm when you fail it the second time?
It's very rare, frankly, for that to happen. I'm not sure, but I believe at that point they would, you know, they would let you go.
Does the law firm often help? Like if you fail the first time, do they try to assist you in some way? Because they have this interest in keeping you or?
Well, the truth is, you know, it's a little bit of the rich get richer story. I mean, when you go to a fancy law firm, even before you get there, they help you. They pay for your bar prep. You know, they give you materials. They give you time off. They give you a salary. It's, you know, I don't want to say it's unfair. I'm not judging it. I'm just telling you the facts. And I don't know what happens if you fail, but I'm sure they do everything they can to, I think that happened in the John Grisham, you know, the firm, you know, before he took the bar. Not that that's a realistic story, but I think that, remember they gave him these big stacks of bar prep materials.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mitch McDear, Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. But you have to wonder, you know, don't the law schools deserve a little bit of their blame, right? If there are graduating students who can't pass the bar, but they passed all those classes.
Especially if you start thinking about how much revenue those schools take in. And especially when you start considering how we've got this student loan system that is funneling this money to the schools, then they just completely abdicate responsibility and go, oh, you didn't pass the bar. Oh, the bar, that's the state bar. That's a different, you know, and you get people like, you know, Dean Fagman at Hastings. He's constantly railing about, oh, the California bar is too hard. It's like, well, no, asshole, stop admitting people who can't pass the California bar.
Yeah. I mean, there's data out there predicting, you know, fairly accurately whether someone is going to have trouble on the bar. So it has to do with LSAT scores, actually. So you'll be glad to know. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. You don't want to discourage people, but, and you know, with tuition, even at state schools, so high now, you know, it's a serious concern.
Yeah, it's wild. When you look at the state school pricing, it doesn't look any different. It's almost like they're just looking to these higher priced schools, and that's making also too high of a price look okay, because, well, we're cheaper than they are by $10,000. But
yeah, still. I mean, I remember because I had to take out a lot of loans. You know, you just sign and kind of close your eyes. Now, I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying, you know, when you're that age and you made the choice, at some point, it's really hard to think about the difference between $70,000 of debt and $30,000 or $180,000. You just sort of sign, and then you wake up one day and
then you start to realize you have to like start making those payments. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then for many people, it does pay off, and you know, they have very good careers and they pay off their law school loans. I don't mean to be negative, but it's absolutely something to take seriously.
Now, we're just realists here. I mean, you know, that because I was a first generation college student, I was had no clue what I was doing when I went into law school. And yeah, it was so easy, you know, for them to talk me into, oh, law school is going to be a transformative experience. You know, you're not going to let money be a factor. They almost like acted like that idea smelled bad. You know, it was this like, ooh, you're going to let money be a factor in your decision. I mean, law school, I've never in my whole career, this is what the admissions office told me, in my whole career, I have never had anybody tell me that they had a problem paying back their loans.
Well, that's just false, right? It's just false. I mean, I can't say for sure, but I know many people who have had to make very different life choices and career choices based on their debt load. I mean, you can only, you know, delay the payments for so long. I mean, I remember a few years ago hearing that Justice Thomas had finally paid off his law school loans. And I know Supreme Court justices don't make a huge amount of money, but they make a few hundred thousand bucks, and he's not that young. I'm not sure exactly how old he is. And I can see how it could happen, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you pay the minimum, you could see decades going by and still being in debt.
Wow. One thing you mentioned earlier, Ross, was that your book is given to law students, right? Or assigned for some classes. Which book is that? Is that Point Made?
Yeah, Point Made is a lot of law schools assign it or recommend it in the 1L, the legal writing class, but also some upper level classes and clinics. It came out in, the first edition came out in 2011. So it's actually sold a lot of copies. It's kind of amusing, you know, well over 100,000 copies.
The title again is Point Made, How to Write Like the Nation's Top Advocates. It's available on Amazon, Kindle, audiobook, paperback. Oh, you can even get an audio CD. Don't imagine you're selling very many of those anymore. Yeah.
I didn't even know they existed. Yeah. The actor on the audiobook has a good voice. People mention that a lot.
Oh, so, cool. Okay.
It's not Morgan Freeman, but still a pretty good voice.
I mean, that's a book that really, I guess I remember vaguely working on that book, and you were using actual examples from, right, briefs that were written by John Roberts and other top advocates when they were attorneys. So, I mean, I loved that aspect of it. It's like, here's an actual example, right? Sometimes that's often missing when people are trying to teach something. But my sense was this was targeted to attorneys who are much more experienced, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm glad that anybody reads my books, but I am happy and maybe pleasantly surprised that so many law students read it. Not because I wrote it, although maybe a little bit, but because a lot of law students, you know, who do find the first year a little overwhelming of the things they have to read, right? I mean, there are many things they'd rather read than my stupid book, but because there are these little bite-sized examples from a lot of well-known lawyers, it helps with writing, but also just gives them a sense of, you know, how a lot of these famous cases actually were argued, which in a digestible way. So that wasn't really the purpose. That wasn't my like fundamental purpose in writing the book, but it does give people, you know, multiple layers of, you know, the practice of law.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, what advice do you have for new law students or people about to go to law school? Should they read your book? What things should they do to get ready or to do well once they're there?
I'd sleep in, you know, relax a little bit. Yeah, I don't know about reading a lot of books. I would say on a more serious note that if you're like me and really don't know that much going into law school, or like me, frankly, know nothing or somewhere in between, I do think it's good to have a little bit of a sense of what these major classes are all about. So when you go to contracts the first day, you know, torts, you know, property, I mean, criminal law, most people have a sense of just from living and reading the news, but I know people say, oh no, the professor's going to teach it in his or her own way. Oh, come on. There's not that much variation, right? The cases are the same. So I think whatever it takes, you could ask ChatGPT, you know, okay, give me a little primer on torts. I do think it helps. I've given this advice to, you know, family, friends, or random would-be law students who contact me, and they say they're glad they took it. So whatever you want to do is fine. I mean, you could talk to someone, you can use AI, you can find some short ebooks somewhere, but I would want to know a little bit about those major classes before I went in.
So figure out what classes you're going to take, which is going to be torts and all these standard first
year classes. You don't usually have too many choices, even today, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they've shaken it up a little. I think sometimes some schools do con law now in the first year. But generally, like I said before, the curriculum probably could change a little bit more than it has. It's been pretty standard for many decades.
One thing I remember was that a lot of law students, it seemed like, and I'm including myself in this group, of course, you read all these cases and they're written in this old writing style that's hard to follow and uses a lot of words that you probably need to know but don't need to use in your own writing. And then it seems like students try to be like attorneys and start writing like the way they read. Is that still a thing?
It's a shame that there's no sense of what the goal of a judge should be in those first year classes. In other words, you know, they go on and on about the details of the cases, and the professors will praise or more often critique the reasoning. But if you pay attention, and you know, I would get a little bored, I'll admit, in law school, and we didn't have any other distractions like laptops. So I'm not embarrassed to admit, I would actually, even as a 1L, look at the sentences and the words. You'll notice just as you go along that you'll just get the point much more easily when certain judges or justices have written the opinion than others. So one thing I tell judges when I train them is that is one of their responsibilities, right? If they're going to write a major case that's going to appear in case books for, you know, generations of law students might read it. And it's their, I believe it's their duty because of their, you know, the power they've been given to craft the common law and the administrative state to make their reasoning clear, right? Beginning with law students. And then obviously it should be clear for the lawyers who have to apply the stupid case to their clients' facts as well. So there, it's a good opportunity, I think, for these professors to point these things out and really say, you know, whether you're liberal or conservative, you're going to find in law school, I can promise all of you, if an opinion is written by Justice Scalia or Justice Kagan, you're going to be able to understand it really easily, whether you agree with it or not. And that's not magic, right? That's why they're in my books a lot, Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan, because they actually, you know, I don't know exactly why, but they actually make themselves be as clear as day in their prose style.
And their structure and their organization and how they lay out their points.
Yes. And that's important, not just because it makes it easier to understand the opinion and apply it, but because it makes it, it actually makes their reasoning more powerful. It's more powerful. It's you can see it and then you can really engage with it. Whereas a lot of the time you read a lot of these judges' opinions, and as you said before, you're scratching your head like, what the heck are they even talking about?
Yeah, you're gonna make your opinion much more lasting and powerful if you make it clear. You make it so, you know, other opinions are so vague that they then get twisted to mean the exact opposite of what they probably meant in the moment when they wrote it.
Yeah. So you'll notice if you end up in law school, like if you read an opinion by Justice Kennedy, you'll be very flowery. And you'll often not know, whatever it's about, you'll often not know at the end what exactly the holding was, because it's just kind of flowery.
Yeah, he figured out how to reach the decision he wanted to reach, but you're like trying to follow the logic going, wait, how did you, wait, it's upheld?
I thought that was, And that has huge consequences, of course, because of all the lower court judges who then apply the opinions.
Mm. So then more litigation to try to clarify exactly where the line is.
Right. And then, you know, because you don't, I mean, again, it's a little better now, but because you don't actually see what the lawyers produced in these cases, you don't have this sense of what makes someone a great lawyer, other than, you know, oral advocacy, which, you know, is actually not that important for most lawyers. Writing is 10 times more important. So it was really only after law school that I began to study the great brief writers as opposed to just the great judges.
Mm, yeah, because law school is focusing on the written opinions, but attorneys or law students aren't generally getting ready to become a judge. They're getting ready to become a practicing attorney, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the only time in law school I saw a complaint or an answer, I mean, all the things I used to teach 3Ls just a few years later, I had never seen in law school except when I was a summer associate, you know, a motion, a brief. I'd never seen any of those in law school itself. And I would not have been able to name a single great litigator or great brief writer, you know, other than like Thurgood Marshall or someone that everybody knows. And I would not have known who the great living, you know, advocates were at the level of writing, at least.
And you would include John Roberts in that list, right? You mentioned Scalia and Kagan and.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that's actually how I started my career. Or maybe that was how I jump-started my career. I wrote an article, I think you might have been around then, Ben, called Five Ways to Write Like John Roberts. And it, you know, they didn't have the term viral like they do now, but it kind of went viral. And it was just a short article. And, you know, I don't know, maybe a half a page on each of the five techniques, but no one had ever done it before. No one had ever taken a great brief writer and actually tried to turn it into a system. In this case, five techniques. And that actually... Then I got a book deal, you know, from mm-hmm. Oxford, and that really, nothing really changed. I just expanded that into a book. And instead of having one brief by John Roberts, I had, you know, 50 advocates. But that was sort of my creation, I'd say, was the idea that you can actually make this a science and learn it and teach it and understand it. Doesn't mean it's easy. It's just like golf lessons, you know, woodworking. It's not always easy, but I tried to make it more of a system. And not something like literature. Ironically, that was my PhD. It was like linguistics, literary theory, So I ended up finding great joy in the idea that legal writing was much more of a science and not like poetry.
Well, I think that's true for a lot of things, right? The best performers tend to be more similar than different, maybe in a lot of ways, and at least in some of the things that they do.
Like the happy families, according to Tolstoy, versus the unhappy ones. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, going back to what I said about Scalia and Kagan, in a time of great divisiveness, I think it's reassuring that, you know, Kagan, a Scalia, a Roberts, at the level of writing are almost indistinguishable, other than when they're being rhetorical, right? Or they're angry, and then they have different ways of being sarcastic and so forth. But if you take those minor phrases or sentences out, otherwise, very much the same. And that's one of the things I learned writing that book, is that even if you go back in time, although, yeah, people were more stuffy in some ways or used slightly different diction, a lot of the things that make great legal writing great haven't changed and will not change.
Fellas, I have a hard out, so I'm going to let Ben finish the interview. You guys haven't even talked about AI, ChatGPT, but I got to run. Ross, super nice to meet you. I'll let you guys figure it out. Bye.
Great. See ya. Yeah, Ross, you know, one thing I think I saw in an article or something, it sounded like you were planning to standardize legal writing.
Well, so I've created this software, Briefcatch, as you mentioned in your introduction.
Yeah.
That edits legal documents and makes suggestions and shows examples. So I just took VC funding, and one of the things we're doing is creating an advisory board. So I can't say today like who's on it, but some very big names are going to be on it. And it's not that we're going to literally standardize it. We're not going to say like this is the best way to write. But to the point of our earlier discussion, going to try to get some agreement that we can pass down even to law students on what makes great legal writing great, and do it at a very granular level, not theories again, but like use these words and don't use these words, start sentences this way and not that way. And I'm really excited about it because one of the impetus for my software is empirical data. So I have a lot of data on what the great legal writers do differently from the rest of us. And this is just going to give us another dimension, of empiricism to back up a lot of the suggestions in the software.
When you talk about these suggestions, it makes me think of the elements of style. Is it sort of like that, where you're sort of coming down on some issues and saying, hey, this is probably the preferred way to communicate this?
Yeah, I mean, elements of style is interesting because most people get it assigned in college, or they get it as a high school graduation present, wrapped in Amazon plastic. They never take off. It's by far the world's best-selling writing book, without a close second. But they actually wrote it a little bit on a whim, and they didn't really mean for it to, become definitive. And a lot of what's in it is actually wrong. For example, the examples of passive voice are mostly incorrect. But it's still a great book in spirit. And I would say, yes, it was prescriptive, as they say. It's prescriptive in the sense of, hey, do this, not that. But where I'm different is I don't say do this, not that, unless very famous people do the thing I'm saying to do, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to tell people to not start sentences with however, or to start sentences with however, it's not because I personally think so. It's because that's what Chief Justice Roberts does.
Yeah,
or doesn't do, and so forth. So yeah, maybe a little bit more systematic than Strunk and White elements of style. But in the sense, the good thing about that book, whatever its flaws, is it is quite specific, right? It gives you guidelines.
Like you can look it up. And so in some ways, you're both, well, I guess this is always true for prescriptive tips, I guess. You are being descriptive, right? You're saying, hey, this is what they do. You're describing what they do. And then the implication of that is maybe
I would say that I'm descriptive, not prescriptive. But I'm not telling people what the average lawyer does. I'm telling them what the really, really talented ones do, which is sort of like my own variation on a theme, which also makes my work really fun, even after all these years, because you get new kids on the block emerging who are stars. And, you know, as much as I said, Lee Goring doesn't change, of course, it changes a little bit. And I'm always looking to see what the great, you know, the new generation of great upheld advocates, for example, is up to.
So we do have a new kid on the block. That's ChatGPT. A lot of people listening wonder, hey, is there even going to be a job for me when I get out of law school 4 years, 5 years from now? I don't know that we can say, but I definitely see it helping, right? And if it's helping, then it's reducing the demand for the number of attorneys or something. I mean, that's my rough sense, but
yeah, there's a great, great study. It just came out a couple of days ago from a couple of law professors, but it's very practical. And what they did is they took their exams that they gave, you know, real law students, and then they administered the exams again to other law students. And some used only ChatGPT, you know, some used ChatGPT, but they could change, you know, change what ChatGPT said, and then some did it on their own. And, you know, to try to get people to read the study, I won't tell you what the punchline is, but it's pretty fascinating how well ChatGPT does or does not do at answering certain types of questions. But the conclusion the professors drew, I will tell you, and that is that if you think about tiers of legal work, you know, just kind of like the demand on your brain or the level of sophistication, I think there people are coalescing around the notion that a lot of kind of more repetitive legal work or, you know, more routine legal work will be fairly soon replaced by ChatGPT. And then, you know, we hope the opposite is true, that more sophisticated, more tailored work, you know, work that's more strategic, like you're trying to actually help a business, you're trying to help, you know, a plaintiff, you know, a landlord, tenant, you know, somebody who's had a slip and fall. More tailored work, we hope, cannot be replaced by ChatGPT. One problem is, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard that it's not always accurate. There's kind of now a notorious case where a lawyer used ChatGPT in an airline case to cite cases that didn't actually exist. I think people are a little bit too ecstatic about that case. It gives them sort of false hope that all their jobs are secure. I can almost promise you that OpenAI, the company that with its $10 billion for Microsoft, if it wants to figure out how to cite only cases that exist, it will be able to do so very soon. That's the other thing. It's already a pretty incredible product. I use it all the time in my own legal tech business, even today. But, you know, I know Google just announced it's got something it claims is better than ChatGPT coming out. You know, by the time your people listening to you are done with law school, it's hard to even imagine what these AI tools will be capable of.
You said you use it every day. Do you know how attorneys are using it and how you're using it?
Well, it's been a kind of roller coaster these last months in the legal profession. You could almost say phases of, you know, joy, terror, denial, you know, like the stages of grief. Again, people, the reaction to that one case about one lawyer getting sanctioned for one brief kind of tells you people are wanting a narrative that tells them, I don't need to worry about this. I got it. So I'd say right now the consensus is lawyers are definitely use it in the business side of their practice. In other words, they're going to use it for, you know, things like billing and marketing and, you know, tracking cases and, you know, dockets. I think, you know, most people who are not completely anti-tech are comfortable doing that. When it comes to actually using it in your legal work, you know, we'll see. There are some amazing tools out there already that can condense deposition transcripts to key points, you know, that can scan documents and extract key information, that can, you know, like I have my own editing product that can make briefs better. You can get a lot of information very quickly. You can get facts. You know, a lot of times, one thing that's really underplayed in law school is a lot of lawyers spend a lot of the day discovering facts, right? Not case law. They need to find out what happened. You know, what happened in the meeting? What did the contract actually say? There are a lot of tools for that. And I would imagine at some point, people who refuse to use, you know, ChatGPT or other AI products for those things will be at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point clients, you can imagine if you've had the, you know, misfortune perhaps of having to hire a lawyer, clients have a say in this too. It's not just up to the lawyers. And if clients know that, they're looking at their bills and they know that you could have done what you're billing 10 hours for in 3 minutes using ChatGPT. I think if I go to Vegas and bet, I think the clients are going to win that argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and even if the, well, I guess this is all part of the same system, but if your competitors are doing that, then your clients are going to leave you. So either way.
That's right. And, you know, when I was in law school, they were already saying, oh, the billable hour is dying out. Now it's many years later and the billable hour has not died out, but it's not completely false either. You know, there's more flat fee than there used to be and so forth. And in those cases, now interests are maybe more aligned. So when, you know, like with my own product, like one objection people have, although they don't say it publicly, is exactly that. It's like, it's too effective at editing. And now associates won't be able to bill as many hours, you know, at $800 an hour doing basic proofreading. Mm. Well, again, that's not going to be tenable at some point. Right.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot to take in. Any other last words of wisdom, Ross, for aspiring law students?
Well, I'd say it wouldn't hurt to, you know, pick someone, you know, gave you a couple names of some justices, for example, maybe even people who write about the law, you know, in different newspapers or different online sources. It wouldn't hurt to pick someone who's already either writing legal documents or writing about the law, someone you admire, and even maybe before law school, like dig in a little bit to their prose, like take a look, like why did this person get such a great reputation? You know, everyone agrees Justice Kagan's a great writer. Why? Well, I'll ask people, they'll be like, oh, because she's clear and even sometimes funny. Well, that's useless, right? What are you going to do? Say, okay, well, now I'm going to type and I'm going to be clear and funny. Why is she clear? Well, what does she do? Is it magic? No, it's not magic, right?
Yeah.
It's not magic. Yeah. So I'd say it doesn't hurt to have someone to look up to. Even before law school, as you already start to think about turning yourself into a great, great legal writer.
Wow. Well, great. Thanks for coming on the show, Ross. What's the best way for people to find you if they want to do so?
Just probably through our site, briefcatch.com. We're very modern, reachable.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Briefcatch.
You can follow me on Twitter. I've got a great Twitter following. You know, if you don't like me, I've got great followers, like 25,000 or so. And that's at Legal Writing Pro. You were around, I think, for the creation of that feed, Ben.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So is it still called Twitter or is it X now?
I think it's X. I can't do it. I can't call it
you
X.
Can't, you can't call it no. X.
Okay. I try to adapt, but some things are just too ingrained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm calling it Twitter.
Okay.
Maybe Elon Musk can come after me if he wants, but I don't know. I don't even like that, the logo. I don't like that X. I like the little logo. Bird. The bird was better.
Yeah. The bird is better. Okay. Well, great. And people can even, do people use Briefcatch in law school? They must.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, law schools buy it. A few law schools buy it or, you know, different classes and we have student discounts, but don't spend your money on my software before law school. even at the student discount, you can wait. You get a free trial. How about that? You take the free trial and don't forget to cancel.
Yeah. I just remember when you were working on that, you mentioned something like, I don't remember, but it felt like the tens of thousands of rules that you've personally created, right? Like, it's like you've thought of every variant possible in the different phrasings.
It's been like three or four years putting the, you know, previous 20 years of teachings into code. And it's, I mean, I'm not embarrassed to say I wake up every day and I'm as excited as ever. I love legal tech. I mean, I never expected to be in legal tech space or hiring software developers or running a corporation, but yeah, it's really, really fun. I mean, this is my life's work, right? I mean, a lot of people would probably think it's torture, but I love it. I love these new AI tools. I really enjoyed the challenge of trying to take everything I know about legal writing and, again, you know, not, I don't code it, but I have to turn it into a form that the coders and developers can use. And it's an exciting time. It's an exciting time, I'd say, to enter the profession for that reason. There's a lot of, there's anxiety, of course, about tech, but also just a lot of excitement. I'm going to the, this weekend at the world's biggest legal tech conference, and I've gone 3 years in a row. It's in Disney World, so people will be happy anyway. But yeah, people are just ecstatic at this conference. Like, they're the happiest lawyers you'll ever see. Everyone's just, smiling and full of ideas and optimism about these possibilities.
Yeah. So I guess there's risk, but also huge opportunities, right? For people who want to dive in and
sure. And to be honest, they're also happy because you can make a huge amount of money selling legal tech. But
yeah,
it doesn't mean it's not good too, though.
Right? Yeah.
It can be lucrative and also it's helpful. And also there are good access to justice reasons to have tech. A lot of people can't afford lawyers, or they can't afford, high priced lawyers. And that's important too.
Well, thanks again, Ross. We can find you at briefcatch.com. That's right.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Great to see you, Ben.
Yeah, likewise. All right. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you can always email help@lsatdemon.com. They are an amazing help team, by the way. You can also check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. Ross, thanks again for coming on the show today. It was great to hear what you have to share with everyone. That was episode 416 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.